I am so insecure right now, it's incredible. You people are frightening. Daniel 11 is a very difficult chapter. I do not claim to be an expert. I have three different Adventist books from three people that I greatly admire, and the three don't exactly agree. But I know that where they're coming from, I'm comfortable with. I just happened to go on the internet and notice that my great Sir Isaac Newton also saw Antiochus Epiphanes from verse 15 onward, which was a great disappointment to me, but it doesn't surprise me because he didn't know what we know now, even though he was a brilliant man and had the rest of the prophecies in Daniel pretty well figured out, just like Adventists believe today. I recently attended a theological presentation at Andrews University in which one of our premier younger theologians presented an entire paper that claims that Antiochus Epiphanes is nowhere to be found in chapter 11. And I scoured my office because I brought his paper back with me and I couldn't find it. Yeah, I did. But all I have to do is call Andrews and talk to the doctor. And I know he'll send me another one. But when you attend the seminar, they always give you stuff. And I was surprised to find out, I mean, not surprised, but in light of what he presented, Bill Shea does see Antiochus Epiphanes in verse 14 and 15. But he says, and there's a reason he sees that. He sees that because usually they talk about the kings or the powers that are involved until they introduce the next power on the scene. And of course, Antiochus Epiphanes is the one that went down to Egypt and was confronted by none other than an ambassador from Rome who told him to turn around and go home, and he obeyed him. The ambassador had no army. He met him individually. And so he sees that he's introduced right at that those two verses, and then it shifts over to Imperial Rome. I'll show you that. You just need to know that I'm not claiming to be an expert in this. I'm going to give you the best understanding that I have from some of the minds that I greatly respect in our church, which includes Bill Shea and Leslie Harding, and Jacques Ducan. And I wish I could have read the paper that I lost. In fact, I'm trying to remember the name of the professor right now, and it's escaping me. And so I'm going to go through this, and I'll tell you how I deal with chapter 11. And I seriously considered presenting it to you this way, in a very simplified form. And that is, there's a couple of texts that for sure we can nail down a historical figure. And it doesn't matter about all the rest of them if we know, you know, like your signpost, you may miss the advertising billboards on what's coming as long as you know the signpost said it's still in that direction. You got me? So I got the signposts. Like the one that says that he'll come and he'll tax his empire. Well, I know that's Caesar Augustus. And of course, the futurists see that as Antiochus Epiphanes. The preterists see that as Antiochus Epiphanes. But it's interesting because I know who that ruler that came that taxed the people was, Caesar Augustus. And right after him came Tiberius, and that's when the Prince of the Covenant was killed. I can nail those two texts down. I may not be able to explain the other 33 above it. But when you can nail those signposts down, you feel comfortable about your understanding. You're going in the right direction. So I toyed with the idea of just doing that, but instead I've almost given you almost given you a blow-by-blow, verse-by-verse, until I felt that we could start deviating at the end to more general terms. And I think you'll see. Hopefully this will help. Okay? Yes. No. No. Ellen White has very little on chapter 11. And that's okay, because at that time that wasn't the issue. Yes, Sandra? It's all historical, right? For me, I almost considered coming here and starting with verse 40. I have no problem with verse 40. And I was going to start there. Then I thought, no, some of you may be upset if I did. And we're getting more and more understanding of it. Exactly. So we're in the ballpark. Okay? Let's pray. And then we'll get started. And we'll see if the Lord can relieve some of my anxiety here. Father in heaven, I thank you for this moment and opportunity, because when we challenge even ourselves, Lord, we learn. I just don't want to embarrass you in the process. And I pray that you would make sense out of Daniel 11 as you have helped me to understand it better, but I've got to be able to explain it because they have come here to try to understand. So, Lord, open our hearts and minds. But let us clearly see that what's revealed there is the history supports the understanding of the Seventh-day Adventist Church in its prophetic interpretation and points to the soon coming of Jesus, the Antichrist power that will oppose the law of God, and that your people will be delivered. So use me now, Lord, and remind me of all the things that I've studied and learned so that I can share them so that it can be clearer. That's our intention tonight. So bless to this end, bless each person who's come. Open our hearts, our minds to your truth. And Lord, if Satan is lingering anywhere, or if he happened to come in the back pocket of somebody, I pray that you now banish him from this property. We don't want confusion or interruption. We just want your sweet spirit and holy angels to fill this room so that they can't even hear what we're saying, much less be part of the presentation. So guide and direct. You're the boss. We love you and want to give you the honor and glory. So blessed to this end, in Jesus' name, amen. Well, let me show you what I picked up first. I'm worried about the time, so I'm still going to hesitate on who's Michael. I gave you the information at the beginning here of chapter 11, but that is from chapter 10. I'm going to hold off on that, and I'm going to go right down to the section that says the relationship of Daniel 11 and 8 and 9. Remember I talked about signpost? And let me remind you of something again. This is what's very interesting to me. We understand that in prophetic utterances, God used the principle of repeat and enlarge. So he will give a prophecy, and then later on he'll repeat the prophecy, but in so doing he gives us additional information. That is exactly what 2, chapter 7, chapter 8 and 9, and chapter 10, 11, and 12 do. And how interesting that the preterist and the futurist will, towards the chapter 8, come up with a different interpretation than they did in 2 and 7, in which they basically agree with us. And they start adding new figures and new individuals and deviate from the course and muddy the waters. So we are going to see that we've got to come from the hermeneutical principle. That's a principle for interpreting the Bible. That you look for the parallelism. And that's how you can be sure the Bible's interpreting itself. So, here's chapter 11, And then on the right column is Daniel 8 and 9. So notice, 11 verse 2 introduces the king of Persia. And of course, we find the ram of king of Persia in 8:20. And also in 11:2, it introduced the kingdom of Rome. And we find the goat, kingdom of Greece, and we find the goat of Greece is 8:21. And then Daniel 11:3 is a mighty king in Greece, and we know that's Alexander the Great. And we find Alexander the Great, the large horn, the first king of Greece, is 8:21. And then in Daniel 11:4, we find the four winds, which is the scattering of the empire of the great king. The great king was Alexander the Great, and it broke up into four divisions to his four generals. And we find that in Daniel 8:22. And then in verse 16, it mentions the beautiful land. And the beautiful land is conquered in verse 16 of chapter 11. And of course, in Daniel 8, verse 9, pagan Rome conquers the beautiful land of Israel. And then when we get to 11:22, it says the prince of the covenant will be destroyed. And according and over in Daniel 9, verse 25, the pagan Roman Empire cuts off the anointed one at Calvary. So I want you to see, and by the way, that means that we've got a sure signpost in verses 16 and 22. And in those signposts, they can show us where we historically are. It's amazing to see how they try to interpret and fit Antiochus Epiphanes into these verses. See, remember in verse 16 of chapter 11, remember this, Antiochus Epiphanes never conquered the beautiful land. His father did. When he took over the kingdom, his father had conquered it. So the wording in verse 16 says the beautiful land will be conquered. And that did not happen until after Rome overthrew Syria. Antiochus Epiphanes was long gone, and they're the ones that conquered the beautiful land again. So I want to just try to plant this in your mind. I want you to just see how I like to think. I try to make it as simple as possible, even though I go into a greater depth here than I would have for my own sake. Please understand that the wording of chapter 16 is the beautiful land was conquered. Antiochus did not conquer it. His father did. When he took over the kingdom, it was already part of his empire. Even though he did all the dastardly things he didn't conquer it. But after his kingdom came the Roman kingdom, and they conquered it. And that's exactly what we find in Daniel chapter 8, verse 9. Pagan Rome conquered the beautiful land. Okay, so you understand what I'm saying? I hope I got you. Did I confuse anybody? Okay. And then when we come to Daniel 11:22, it says the prince of the covenant will be destroyed. I want you to know, you've got to study again, and I don't want to beat a dead horse here. Antiochus Epiphanes did not destroy Jesus. He tried to institute a pagan worship. He didn't try to replace Jesus. Instead, he wanted his form of worship to be... he tried to get them to worship his way. He didn't attack Jesus. He closed down the temple, inserted the temple on an altar for Zeus, and he sacrificed a pig on it. But he never said, I'm the God. He said, Zeus is the God. That's who we're worshiping. So he never killed the Messiah the way pagan Rome killed the Messiah. Am I right? And the way papal Rome killed the Messiah by placing replacing his ministry in heaven with the priest on earth. Okay? So you can see the parallelism here between 11, 8, and 9. In the process, you get an idea where 11's at. Because believe me, I'm going to start reading some verses now. And when I do, hopefully you've read these verses, you'll just scratch your head. But it is, as Sandra said, it's history. And it's amazing how some of these commentators, even non-Adventists, agree on the characters that are being described here. Okay, so let's start. Let's read verse 1 through 4. In the first year of Darius, the Median king... In the first year of Darius the Mede, I arose to be an encouragement and a protection for him. And now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings are going to arise in Persia. Then the fourth will gain far more riches than all of them. As soon as he becomes strong through his riches, he will arouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece. And a mighty king will arise, and he will rule with great authority and do as he pleases. But as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out towards the four points of the compass, though not to his own descendants, nor according to his own authority, to his authority, which he yields, for his sovereignty will be uprooted and given to others besides them. By the way, that means it didn't go to his family, it went to his generals. Okay, so in verse 1, who is the I in verse 1? In the first year of Darius the Mede, I arose to be an encouragement and a protector for him. Yeah, Gabriel, I heard Jesus. It's an angel or Gabriel. Right. It's an angel or Gabriel. And remember, when we opened up in 10, Daniel was praying, and Gabriel came and said, I've been over there wrestling with the kings and princes of Persia.
In 10:20, doesn't it indicate that it's Jesus that's speaking now?
Well, I can't say for sure that that's Jesus, and I haven't found a commentator yet that staked his life on it. But you might be right, and I may need to reread it. But for sure, it's Gabriel. He's continuing to talk to Daniel. Remember, he's the one ordered to give him understanding. And then verse 2 is talking about Persia. They all agree with that. Verse 3 is talking about Greece. Verse 4 is Alexander's empire is divided. And I reminded you, Macedonia was given to Cassandra. Thrace in northwest Asia Minor was given Lysimachus. And the last two are the major players here as we continue in history. Syria and Babylonia went to the general Seleucus. And Egypt went to Ptolemy, the general Ptolemy. And the reason why from now on it's going to talk repeatedly until we hit our transition point, it's going to talk repeatedly about the king of the north, which would be the Seleucid king, and the king of the south, which is the Egyptian king, and they fight back and forth. And guess who's right in the middle?
Jerusalem
is right in the middle. Right. Okay? Okay, so let's go to verse 5 through 15. And notice the interplay here. This is amazing, okay? Then the king of the south will grow strong along with one of his princes, who will gain ascendancy over him and obtain dominion. His dominion will be a great dominion indeed. And after some years, they will form an alliance, and the daughter of the king of the south will come to the king of the north to carry out a peaceful arrangement. But she will not retain her position or power, nor will she remain with her power, but she will be given up along with those who brought her in and the one who sired her, as well as he who supported her in those times. Now, let me just stop for a second and notice verse under 5 through 15, it has verse 5. I've read 5 and 6. Notice that that just about all the commentators say the king of the south here that they're talking about is Ptolemy the one Soter. And that the king of the north of Syria is Seleucid one Nicanor. And then in verse 6, the king of the south is referred to first, and that's Egypt, Ptolemy the second Philadelphus. And the king of the north is, for Syria is Antiochus the second Theos. Now, I gave you that because it turns out that most commentators agree with these names. If there's a variance, it's a variance that's so slight that it actually follows a historical sketch of what was going on between the battle of the north and the south, the king of the north and the south. Including Bernice got herself in this thing too. Notice that they tried to make an alliance by the sister of the king of the south married the king of the north, and then he spurned her and she died, and then the king of the south got mad about that and came back after. I haven't read that part yet, but this is what it's all about. And they have this pretty well historic, and it doesn't mean anything for your salvation. Okay? And I could sound really intelligent to you and impress you to death, but you know, it just doesn't get me as excited as it does to where we get to the later part of Daniel 11, in which we clearly see God's people and their interaction with the papacy, and then the time of the end, which starts in verse 40. Okay, so I just stopped at 6. Let me continue at 7. But one of the descendants of her line will arise in his place, and he will come against their army and enter the fortress of the king of the north, and he will deal with them and display great strength. And also their gods with their metal images and their precious vessels of silver and gold he will take into captivity to Egypt. And on his part he will refrain from attacking the king of the north for some years. Then the latter will enter the realm of the king of the south, but will return to his own land. Okay, verse 7 in your paper there, that's the king of the south is Ptolemy the third, Eurygetes. And verse 8 is the king of the south, Ptolemy the third, Eurygetes. And wait, did I repeat my, where am I? Oh, and verse 5 or verse 9 is the king of the north is Seleucid the second. So this is how they see these people and their interaction. And they went and they fought. And of course, the king of the south won there and brought even the vessels from, you know, their god and their idols back to Egypt, which showed how powerful they were. They continue to fight back and forth, and it wanes. And what's the word that goes with the wanes, back and forth? Waxes and wanes, yeah. One side gets the upper hand, then the other side gets the upper hand. Poor Jerusalem's right in the middle. Okay. Let's see, where did I leave off? Verse 9? 10. And his son will mobilize and assemble a multitude of great forces, and one of them will keep on coming and overflow and pass through, that he may again wage war on his very fortress. And the king of the south will engage and go forth and fight against the king of the north. By the way, look at verse 11. That's Antiochus the third Magnus. That's Antiochus Epiphanes' father. He's the one that conquered Jerusalem. Then the latter will rise, will raise a great multitude, but that multitude will be given into the hands of the former. And when the multitude is carried away, his heart will be lifted up, and he will cause tens of thousands to fall, yet he will not prevail. For the king of the north will again rise, a great multitude, then former, and after an interval of some years, he will press on with a great army and much equipment. Now, I stop here, and I quote literally from Bill Shea's book. I want you to see what Bill Shea says. Upon this point, the time of Antiochus III, verse 13, almost all commentators agree upon the identification of the various kings of the north and south. The question is, what happened after the time of Antiochus the Third? Okay, are you with me so far? We're on verse 13. Are you with me? Most commentators agree with what I put here in this paper, which one they're talking about, which is inconsequential, except it shows the accuracy. Don't get me wrong, I'm not downplaying the accuracy. But I am not one of those, when it comes to researching historical facts like pulling out which king is which and so forth, is not my thing. So I took it from Bill Shea. And notice what he says here in his book. Then he goes on, futurists, interpreters, take everything from verse 13 to 35 as referring to Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. Since he was responsible for introducing Rome on the scene of action in the Middle Ages, he makes an appropriate transitional point to Rome, just as Xerxes made an appropriate transitional point to Greece. I forgot to tell you that, didn't I? In verse 3 it says, "And a mighty king will arise, and he will rule with a great authority and do as he pleases." Now Bill Shea says that Hebrew term, "do as he pleases," always introduces a new king on the scene of action. And we're going to find that that's exactly what happens in verse 14 and 15. And so he's saying that the futurists see Antiochus Epiphanes from verse 13 to 35. Now notice the next chapter or the next paragraph. But applying only verse 14b and 15 to Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, that's what Bill Shea does. We whittle him down to his proper historical size. He was, after all, only a minor king who ruled a minor kingdom only a short time, 175 BC to 163 BC. He did behave badly towards the Jews in Judea, but the major turning point of his reign was when he had to cave in to diplomatic pressure from Rome. Rome was already a major player on the horizon in the Middle East. And in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, he knew better than to try to thwart its design. It required only a single Roman ambassador, not an army, to turn Antiochus Epiphanes from his second invasion of Egypt in 168 BC. Okay, so what Bill Shea is saying here, and what I tend to agree with, or as best I can tell, is verse 14 and 15 deal with Antiochus Epiphanes purely because he is the one that brought Rome into action by going to Egypt and being turned away. Then Rome became the preeminent power in the Middle East, see, even though they didn't conquer it till a little bit later. Yes? He was a catalyst. And by the way, they say Xerxes was the... Remember, it says, "And now I will tell you the truth," verse 2, "Behold, three more kings are going to rise in Persia, and then the fourth will gain more riches than all of them. As soon as he becomes strong, though through his riches, he will arouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece." Xerxes actually went to war with Greece, and he was defeated. And from that point on, notice, it transferred, even though there were some further Persian kings, it doesn't mention those other Persian kings. It then skips to Greece. Because when Xerxes went against them and was defeated in battle, now you know the preeminent power at that time was transitioning to Greece. So they no longer mentioned any of the other remaining Persian kings that followed Xerxes.
Was Xerxes the king when Helen of Troy was being invaded, which is a time of
And I believe that was when Esther was there. Helen of Troy. I don't know about that.
Well, like proving it was a Troy city.
And what I mean is, I don't know it. I'm not saying you're wrong.
No, but I'm saying this because that's when Greece was falling, because of the simple fact that they had put so much into Turkey, they couldn't stand to Rome. So they had to resort to
these
when they went under.
Okay, that could very well be. That's the point. It brought Greece on the scene of action, even though there followed another couple or so Persian kings. And after Antiochus, there were further Syrian kings, but the point is Rome took the scene of action from that point on. So Bilshay says at this point he exits chapter 11. And remember, the futurists say that 15 to 35 is purely Antiochus Epiphanes, including the one who conquered the beautiful land, which he didn't, and including the one that cut off the Prince of the Covenant, which he didn't. Okay? All right, so let's look. So therefore, we take the position that approximately in verse 16 through 22 is Imperial Rome. And notice how interesting this is. 16 says, but he will come against him, will do as he pleases, and no one will be able to withstand him. He will also stay for a time in the beautiful land with destruction in his hands. Now, verse 16 gives us a new power introduced. And notice it says here, there's that term, do as he pleases. You see that? And the New International Version says an invader. It uses the term invader. And by the way, notice, it doesn't say the king of the north. In fact, from this point on, king of the north is not mentioned again until we get to verse 40. So here's a new player on the scene of action. And he, the technical phrase introducing the new character, will do as he pleads. He is not called the king of the north. Now notice this. This is from Young's literal translation. And he, the invader, New International Version, who is coming unto him, Antiochus the Fourth, does according to his will, and there is none standing before him, and he, Pompey, 63 BC, or Rome, standeth in the desirable land, and it is wholly in his hands. That's what Young Literal Translation says. So it recognizes that this is Pompey who comes through Syria and defeats Syria and moves on and defeats the beautiful land. And now he stands in the beautiful land. So this is Rome. This is Imperial Rome. That's what Pompey did. By the way, who followed Pompey? Anybody know? Okay, let's look. Verse 17. Yeah. Notice what it says. And he will set his face to come with the power of his whole kingdom, bringing with him a proposal of peace, which he will put into effect, and he will also give him the daughter of women to ruin it. But he will not take a stand for him. But she will not take a stand for him. And be on his side. Folks, this is Julius Caesar, Cleopatra, and her brother, Ptolemy the 14th. And Julius Caesar marries Cleopatra. They have a baby. Cleopatra even comes back to Rome. And you know what happened to Julius Caesar. And we're going to see that in verse 18, the next verse. And she flees for her life back to Egypt. And there she dies of an asp bite. The last what? Man, I didn't even know that. Cleopatra was a direct descendant of Alexander the Great. I didn't know that. I believe you, Susan. Yeah. Well, notice how beautiful and smoothly this moves as you see these signposts. Notice this. So go to verse 18. Then he will turn his face to the coastlands. Now, after he went down through Egypt, and by the way, he went down to Egypt to kill Pompey. He was chasing Pompey down there. And I think Pompey was killed by the Egyptians down there, but he went down there for that purpose. He then had to go back and conquer three coastal areas. Notice what verse 18 says. Then he will turn his face to the coastlands and capture many. And sure enough, as I put there, Caesar's successful campaigns against the Bosporus, North Africa, and Spain. And for what we understand, those are coastal areas. And that's what it says he did. He went back. And I'm spending a lot of time on this, and I didn't want to do it. But you see, it's very interesting because some of the historical facts are so accurate. We follow the line right here. And notice the next Caesar comes along and does taxes. It's really amazing. Okay, so we're in verse 18, and we're doing verse 18. Then he will turn his face to the coastland and capture many. Okay, then B. But a commander will put a stop to his scorn against him. Moreover, he will repay him for his scorn. So he will turn his face towards a fortress of his own land, and he will stumble and fall and be found no more. And so Julius Caesar went back to Rome after conquering these three places. He tried to do away with the Senate and take almost full control. And those people that he chose to be his advisors did what? They killed him. They killed him. They knifed him. And it said that he will stumble and fall and be found no more. They assassinated him. Then look at the next verse. So Julius Caesar was killed in 444 BC. Just as it says there, after conquering those three coastal areas, he goes back, tries to take over as sort of a dictatorship, starts to dismiss the Senate, pulls in some of his closest friends, and they decide to assassinate him. His own friends. Oh, by the way, I didn't read verse 19 too. Oh, yes, I did read 19. So 18 and 19, Julius Caesar. He takes care of those coastal areas, goes back, tries to set up his authority and his own trusted advisors that he chooses to be siding with him in this new institution of control of Rome, kill him. And then notice verse 20. Then in his place one will arise and will send an oppressor through the jewels of his kingdom. Yet within a few days he will scatter, though neither in anger nor in battle. Now, unfortunately, that's what mine says. My margin says in verse 20, then in his place one will arise who sends an exactor of tribute. And most of the, if you read your translation there, it says taxes, right? Yeah, and who is that? Who followed Julius Caesar and taxed his whole empire? Augustus. He's the one that caused Mary and Joseph to have to go to Bethlehem so that the Messiah could be born where he was prophesied to be born. The exact timing. And so the one that followed Julius Caesar after his assassination was Augustus Caesar, who did the tax. And notice the last phrase. It says, and he will be shattered, though neither in anger nor in battle. He died of an illness. He didn't die in battle. He died of an illness. That's exactly what happened to him. And then we go to verse 21, and it says, "And in his place a despicable person will arise on whom the honor of the kingship has been conferred, but he will come in a time of tranquility and seize the kingdom in intrigue." Pardon? Not been what? Not been conferred. Right. Not been conferred. That's right. And so who is this? Tiberius, who is not the natural son of Augustus. In fact, we're told that he did not like Tiberius. And by the way, Tiberius was a scoundrel. And by the way, he was a good general. He did win some battles. We're going to see that. That's exactly what happened here. And I just like scratch my head. How can you fit Antiochus Epiphanes into this stuff? Verse 22. "And the overflowing forces will be flooded away before him and shattered, and also the prince of the covenant." Now that first part of that verse, Tiberius's army was very successful, and he was the king or the Caesar who reigned when Jesus was crucified. He will be flooded away before him and shattered, and also the prince of the covenant. So Jesus Christ was crucified. Now look at verse 22. "And the overflowing force will be a flood, will flood away." Oh, I already said that. I'm sorry. I skipped something here. And notice that's exactly, if we look at Daniel 9:25-27, that's exactly what it says, that the prince of the covenant will be cut off. And now it says the prince of the covenant here in verse... what verse was I on? 22. I keep losing my place. "Also the prince of the covenant." That's Tiberius. Now, I quote again from Bill Shea. Notice what he says at this point. I love this. "Both the historicists and the futurists approach to Daniel 9:24-27 see the Messiah, the prince, mentioned in verse 25 as none other than Jesus Christ. Identifying Jesus as the Messiah, the prince of Daniel 9:24-27 means that when we come to this time in the prophecy, we have come to the time of Jesus of Nazareth as fulfilled of those aspects of that prophecy. This gives us a chronological linchpin upon which to hang verse 22 in the narrative of Daniel 11. Do you understand that? You see what I'm saying? I don't necessarily need to know what 21, 20, 19, 18, 17, 16, although it's nice, don't get me wrong, don't take shortcuts. But since it takes a lot of historical research work to nail down exactly who these different individuals were, we know in verse 22 who the prince of the covenant was. And we know who the Caesar was who put him to death. So we have the linchpin. He calls it a linchpin. By the time we reach this point in Daniel 11, we have reached the first century AD, and the events described here should surround that point. And I think that logic is very sound. Okay, if you pull anything away today, pull away, you know, Pompey conquering the beautiful land. Julius Caesar, Cleopatra, Augusta, Tiberius, verse 22, you know, you can see that. That's easier to see than some of these other things because these other characters are not well known to us. Okay, then we move on to 20, verse 23-39, and now Bill Shea says this is Papal Rome, and he makes it very simple this way. He says that verses 23 through 30, which is a unique understanding and doesn't agree with by Jacques Dukan. I shouldn't say doesn't agree. They see it differently, because I think they're in agreement. And even Leslie Hardy. He sees verse 23 through 30 as the Crusades. Bill Shea. Because he says there's literal battle in those verses. And since verse 22 introduced us to the first century A.D., he said none of the narrative there have seemed to suggest anything about the destruction of Jerusalem. The verbiage doesn't fit the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 A.D. It doesn't seem to fit anything with Constantine, you know, who made the edict to make the Bishop of Rome preeminent and then marched his people through the river. And oh no, Justinian did that. Constantine is the one that... 321. And then marched his army through and made them Christians, you know, through the water, made them Christians. He said none of that fits that. The next scene of action that deals with the Christian church and the papacy is the Crusades. So he sees the Crusades in 23 through 30. Actual military campaign. And then he says verse 30 is the subversion of the system of salvation. 32 and 34 I think we can all agree is persecution. That's pretty clear. Verse 35 through 39 is self-exaltation. Now let's look at those. And after alliance is made with him, he will practice deception, and he will go up and gain power with a small force of people. In a time of tranquility, he will enter the richest part of the realm. He will accomplish what his fathers never did, nor his ancestors. He will distribute plunder, booty, possessions among themselves, and he will devise his scheme against strongholds, but only for a time. Now, I'm going to stop there. You see, his logic is he looks at the Pope actually was instituting armies to go and win back the Holy Land, and he was promising them all kinds of booty. Their pay would be you take whatever you want. It's amazing. It does really, you know, when I read that, the Knights Templar. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they became very wealthy, and he talks about how you can see those beautiful castles that are built around. Well, but also in the Holy Land, where they set up their headquarters after they conquered, and they stayed by until the Muslim hordes came in again and took it over again. Yes. Bertie, shame on you, Bertie. treasure. That was funny. Yes, you're jumping about 1,000 years. That's what he says. He says, you know, the destruction of Jerusalem doesn't appear to be here. He says what Constantine did, what doesn't seem to be here. He said this is about conquest, so the most logical next Christian thing was the papacy instituting or supporting the Crusades. That's what he says. Now, he says also, if you look, he says there's a skip in time between the fourth Persian king and Greece. He says there's a period of time like 500 years or something, maybe not even quite that much. And he says, so we see that in this scenario here, it's not necessarily a sweep of every detail, but he sees this as the Crusades, and it is kind of interesting because then he goes into the Crusades, and what literally happens in these verses did happen because the Crusades came down and attacked the king of the south. And what's the king of the south? Egypt. And they had a battle. And Egypt ended up defeating them. Crusades. And it says that in here. It's very interesting. I got to show you the book. In fact, I feel guilty because I was going to bring the book and I didn't bring the book. And I was going to read to you from parts of it. The Holy Land back. Right. And in including attacking Egypt. And remember, see, that's the problem with this. The immorality of it. They extended their battle. Pardon? Well, but let me say, you're absolutely right, John. What they were doing, I think they were actually going beyond what they were really called to do, because you see, if they defeated these lands, they could take all the riches that they could find. That's how they got rich. He told them, whatever you get, God gives you, you know. That's what the Pope said. Remember his principle here, and it intrigued me as I read this. His principle is, if you read these verses, they're talking about military conquest. And that's exactly what the Crusades were prior to this is before the Reformation. Okay, let's see, where did I leave off? What verse did I stop at? 24? And then notice 25 continues. We go all the way to 30. And he will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south. Now notice, the king of the north isn't mentioned anywhere here. But the king of the south is mentioned. And that remains to be Egypt. And sure enough, they came and fought against Egypt in the Crusades. And he will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south with a large army. So the king of the south will mobilize an extremely large army, a mighty army for war. But he will not stand, for schemes will be devised against him. And those who eat his choice food will destroy him, and his armies will overflow, but many will fall down slain. As for both kings, their hearts will be intent on evil, and they will speak lies to each other in the same table, but it will not succeed, for the end is still to come in the appointed time. And then he will return to his land with much plunder, but his heart will be set against the holy covenant, and he will take action and then return to his own land. At the appointed time, he will return and come into the south, but this time it will not turn out the way it did before. For ships of Chittim will come against him, therefore he will be disheartened and will return and become enraged at the holy covenant and take action, so that he will come back and show regard for those who forsake the holy covenant. How do you like all that? It's pretty confusing, isn't it? And see, I've read all these books and I had all that stuff in my head, and now I present it to you and I get all mixed up in my mind. That's why I like the linchpins. Because we're moving into the next section, which really appeals to me. So whether you accept that that's the Crusades or not, because John is right, we took a jump of 1,000 years. The point is, the next thing we clearly see is found in verse 30 and 31. Verse 31, and forces from him will arise, desecrate the sanctuary fortress, and do away with the regular sacrifice or the daily, and he will set up an abomination of desolation. Now, if you would at this point refer to this little chart I made here, the event, taking away the daily, that's from chapter 8, is not mentioned in Daniel 7, but it is in Daniel 8:11, and it's mentioned here in Daniel 11:31. So now we got verse 22 specifically talks about the prince of the covenant being destroyed. Now here in verse 31, the daily is taken away. And it says the sanctuary will be desecrated and the abomination of desolation will be set up. No, no, we're going back to where the papal see is now being instituted and doing its work of taking away Christ's ministry and replacing it with. Oh, yes. Okay. The military, see, but we moved out of the pagan imperial Rome, and into papal Rome now. But you are correct. Luke makes it very plain that when the armies surround Jerusalem, that's when the abomination is set up. That's when the armies level the city and destroy it and the temple and everything. Yeah, and the believers are to flee before that happens. So here's the parallelism. Chapter 8 and chapter 11, we have another linchpin here. The daily is taken away. That's what it's talked about. In chapter 8, it's taken away, and in chapter 11, it's abolished. Yes. You know, I'm not sure. I guess they stopped when they destroyed the temple, 70 AD, I guess. Oh, yeah, they did. Oh, they continued to do the sacrifices. No, there was no sacrifices done in Rome. You know what, John, if they were, I didn't know that. That's something I need to check on. I didn't know that. Oh, you mean the Essenes or no? Well, what was it now? I can't remember their name. Hopefully it'll come to me. You mean that real strict community? Oh, that would be the Sumerians, yeah. Yeah, this. No, I don't think they did. They didn't. Yeah, because see, remember when the Israelites came back from captivity from Babylon, the Samaritans wanted to join them in building the temple, and I mean the altar. And they told them, no, because you're idolaters. I don't think they were sacrificing themselves. They were just worshiping idols, I believe. Well, I'll check on that. But see, this is problematic. This is really problematic. As John said, we skipped 1,000 years. We get to the Crusades, and then we come to the daily being taken away. Well, the daily being taken away brings us back to the 5th, 6th century AD. And the Crusades were the, 11th, 12th? Century. Yeah, right. But we do know that prophecy does. The book of Revelation does that. The book of Revelation jumps ahead, then it moves back and explains, then jumps ahead and moves back. Yes. Yeah, okay. When Jesus said, when you see, which means it's in the future, the abomination of desolation. It's in the future. So the first time would be when the Roman army came and surrounded Jerusalem and they were begged not to destroy the temple and they hated the Jews so much for what the Jews did. They couldn't control themselves and they destroyed the temple. The second time it happened was when the papal see set up the system of the priest taking over for the intercession. of Jesus Christ, and they took his ministry and cast it to the ground, and they took the altar, ended up at the front of churches instead of in heaven. And you know why? If you've ever been to a Catholic church, or we would walk in and we would touch the holy water and then we would genuflect before our pew because we were bowing to Jesus who was on the altar. See, Jesus is in heaven. He's not on the altar. So we genuflect and then we go in our pew and we do something that this church I wish would do, and that is we'd say a prayer before we started talking and waving around. In fact, in the Catholic Church, we didn't talk and wave around. But that's because we believed that Jesus was right there. Well, you know, he's right here in the Holy Spirit. And sometimes we get a little too frivolous in the sanctuary. Even I do. I do. So I'm trying to balance that. Okay, I think we will agree though. Let's go to persecution 32, 33, 34. This happened during the Dark Ages. It's very clear here. And by smooth words he, the papal see, will turn to godlessness those who act wickedly towards the covenant. But the people who know their God will display strength and take action. They won't tolerate the apostasy, folks. They may not have done it, not may not. Probably did not do it obnoxiously, but they stood up for principle. And then notice the next verse. And those who had insight among the people will give understanding to many, and they would go out and teach people about the Bible, yet they will fall by the sword and by the flame and captivity and by plunder for many days. And that's exactly what happened in the Dark Ages to the Christians who tried to share the Bible and help people to realize that the papal system was perverted, not as a competitive thing, but as an informative thing. Verse 34, now when they fall, they will be granted a little help and many will join with them in hypocrisy. This is clearly persecution. And we know that this describes what happened during the Dark Ages when millions were martyred for standing up for the truth. And it carried on, of course, even in the time of the Reformation, when they made a real break from the church. And the persecutions increased. And then we move to self-exaltation in verse 36. Then the king, notice it does say king of the north, by the way, but I'm all right with that. I mean, I'm not, they don't delineate now king of the north, king of the south, until we get back to verse 4, because that isn't the issue here. This is a new king, a different king. Then the king will do as he pleases. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god and will speak monstrous things against the God of gods, and he will prosper until the indignation is finished, for that which is decreed will be done. Now you go this, you know, look in your margin, and what's reference do you have in your margin? What reference? 2 Thessalonians, which all commentators agree is a description of the Antichrist. He will set himself up in the temple as God, and he will be God. That's what 2 Thessalonians says. In fact, look at 2 Thessalonians. Yeah, in Revelation 13, right. 2 Thessalonians. Boy, I'll tell you, the second time I do this series, I'm going to be really good. Whew. Okay, where are we at? 2 Thessalonians 2, 4. Let no one in any way deceive you, for it will not come unless the apostasy comes first, and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the son of destruction, who opposes and exalts himself above everything so-called God or object of worship, so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as being God. So what we have here in Daniel 11 is almost verbatim of 2 Thessalonians as well as Revelation 13. They all recognize that. This is the Antichrist. This is the papal system. The vicar of the Son of God. And it continues. Let's see, where was I? What verse? 37? Yeah, and he will show no regard for the gods of his father and for the desire of women. Nor will he show regard for any other god, for he is will magnify himself above them all. There's what? Yeah, see, and again, if you excuse me, trying to put Antiochus Epiphanes in here, he didn't make himself God. He didn't do that. But instead, he will honor the gods of fortresses, a god whom his fathers did not know. He will honor him with gold and silver, costly stones and treasure. We know how he had control of many. He even doled out who was king and who could be king here. The papacy, the pope back then. The Messiah? Yeah, my understanding, of course, is that you remember the priests are not allowed to marry. They're not allowed to marry. Yeah, mine doesn't say. It says the desire of women. I'll check that. But what version you got?
I have the Revised Standard Version, Harvard Study Bible.
Okay, so what Sandra's done is shown us the problematic chapter 11. It's really confusing when you don't look at the hermeneutical principle. The Bible interprets itself and it repeats and enlarges. And we see the linchpins and we put the linchpins together. And when we do that, at least we know approximately where we're at and that we can have the assurance that our interpretation is correct. They're all over the map. They're all over the map. Verse, let's see, did I do 39? And he will take action against the strongest of fortresses with the help of foreign gods. He will give great honor to those who acknowledge him, and he will cause them to rule over many. And he will parcel out land with a price. These are all the things the Pope got involved in. Folks, this is why Martin Luther sincerely went to Rome to try to work reform after... Excuse me, that was incorrect. He went to Rome trying to find God, and when he got there, he was appalled at the corruption all along his route that he saw in the different convents or whatever he stayed at, the monasteries he stayed at. When he got to Rome, he was appalled, and he tried to work reforms because he saw all this stuff going on, all this political stuff and greed And when nothing happened, he was forced to take a stand in which he never planned to leave the church. He never planned. When he nailed that 95 thesis that started all of this, where we are today. By the way, he wasn't really the starter of it, but we give him a lot of credit because he nailed the 95 thesis to the door of the church. He really started it all. We are the culmination of that beginning there of the 95 Theses. We are the ones that have refined it through these years and have followed through and not, you know what's happened to the Lutherans, they went just where Luther went and they stopped. And then came along Wesley's and they stopped, the Methodists stopped, and I don't know, you know, the Calvin's group, they stopped with Calvin and they didn't go any farther. And so therefore, we are the last of the line of reformers, and our work is to bring back the law of God, which will bring on the last days, because this is the final work. But Luther started it, and all those men were bold for God, even though they had real glaring errors. Luther said, when he was introduced to those Sabbath keeper Christian sect, he said, kill them all. Didn't quite have it right, but God used him where he was at. So that's where we are. We're in this line. So we clearly hear, we clearly see that when we get to verse 30, around 30, and boy, we can really debate this 23 through 30, whether that's really the Crusades or not. But when we get to 30 through 39, we clearly see the papacy and what it did and how it functioned. And it brings us up to the time of the end. Verse 40 starts with this. And at the time of the end. This is where I wanted to be at the beginning. I even thought, as I told you, I should have just started here and skipped the rest of the chapter. By the way, Bill Shea and all those, they won't comment on this. They will comment a little bit, but they say this is unfulfilled prophecy. See, this is what's beautiful. This now switches from historical to apocalyptic. In verse 40, in the time of the end. But I know what's going to happen in the time of the end because of the great controversy. And notice what it says. In the time of the end, the king of the south will collide with him. And who we've been talking about? The papacy. Yeah. And now notice he's the king of the north. And the king of the north will storm against him with chariots and horsemen and with many ships. And he will enter countries, overflow them, and pass through them. In my mind, we clearly see the time of the end, which was 1798, when the general Berthier marched in to Rome, deposed the Pope and his papal power, took him captive, he died in exile, and he confiscated his property and his riches, and even though they reappointed a Pope, he never rose to fame or fortune until 1929. When my great countryman Mussolini, who was a dirty Italian, he gave the papacy back his property, his wealth, his fame, his fortune. It went berserk with power. It came back into existence.
Well, that's what gave it the political power.
Pardon?
The papacy had some
Okay, but I want you to know that it literally disappeared, though, after Berthier took him captive. I mean, there's a real distinction. It's like he disappeared, even though there were remnants and so forth, and they continued to appoint popes in that. It was nothing like it was during the Dark Ages.
Because he had no political power. Up until then, nobody gave him much credit.
Right.
But once he got political
power, back again. He got the political power back again. Yes. 29. Well, there were popes and so forth, but their influence was negligent because they had lost their... See, Italy, Rome, had given its power to them. It started with Justinian. It actually started with Constantine, Justinian. They really elevated the papacy in Rome to its point of preeminence. But when Mussolini came in, and he confiscated and took him captive, and you know, it just virtually. Berthier, until Mussolini gave his property back. And believe me, just as it says there, he came roaring back to life. The papal system came roaring back to life. It reinstituted its former authority and made an influence. It's incredible what John Paul II has accomplished since 1929. And by the way, notice this if you would. This is exactly what Revelation tells us. 1st of all, the King of the North papacy comes back to life. 3 times in chapter 13, one thing is repeated. You know what that is? The deadly wound was healed. The deadly wound was healed. We know the 7-headed, 10-horned monster had 7 heads, 7 kingdoms that have persecuted God's people. It's very clear and plain. Assyria, Egypt, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, and Papal Rome. Only 7 heads. There isn't an 8th head. And Papal Rome had, one of the heads had a deadly wound that was healed. The only one that came back to life was Papal Rome. That's what Revelation 13 pounds in our head. Notice Revelation 13, with a vengeance he came back to life. All the world wandered after the beast. Yes. You know, I appreciate you, Dean, sharing that. Did you hear what he said? I think he said what you were trying to say. And you know, I didn't catch what you said because, believe it or not, this ex-Roman Catholic, I didn't know whether he still had that those riches or not. And now you're telling me that he still had the riches, he just didn't have the political power.
The treasury that's under the Sistine Chapel?
Yep.
Totally, completely intact prior to the capture.
Okay.
It was never altered.
So all the wealth had maintained, even, but they didn't have the political clout.
So they could not exercise their monetary power because they had no political power to enable them to use money.
Okay, then let's speculate a little bit here. Or we shouldn't, but you know, you hear the story, you read the story in Luke 24 where Jesus walked with the 2 disciples and he said he kept them from seeing him. If they had that immense wealth still at their disposal, only God could have kept them in check from 1798 to 1929. Okay, but now I want to get to the next verse. So we clearly, with a vengeance and thorough. If you look and you read those verses I've got there, the whole world is repeatedly talked about. The whole world. Not just part of the world or a section of the world. The whole world. Now that means, remember the mark of the beast is in the hand or the forehead. That means you don't have to believe it, you just do it. Or in the forehead means that you believe it. This power doesn't care whether you believe it or not, just so you follow it. Notice the mark of God is only in the forehead. Not meaning that we wouldn't do it. It means that we have to believe it. And if you believe it, you will do it. But they're satisfied with you not believing it, but doing it. Yeah, so if you believe it, it's written on your heart. Now, here's the next verse. So check this next verse out. And he also enters the beautiful land, and many countries will fall. Okay, now I'm going to reread that the way it's in the Hebrew. Listen to me. And he, the King of the North, will enter the beautiful land, and many will fall. The word country isn't there. Now let's remember this apocalyptic prophecy. We're talking about the last days. We're not talking about literal Egypt and literal Israel. We are talking about spiritual Israel. So the beautiful land would be the church. Spiritual Israel. This power will enter the church and many will fall. Pardon? Well, it's going to bring the shaking. Yeah. I think we're approaching the shaker right now. I really do. The things that our church is starting to do and say and think just blows my mind. When I say our church, I mean areas of our church. Yeah. You remember where it says they follow the Lamb wherever He goes, and they did not defile themselves with the woman. And who's the woman?
The church.
The false church, the papal system that'll take the hand or the forehead. I clearly see this. I clearly see this. Remember Ellen White saying, it'll appear as if the church is about to fall. Mm-hmm. But it will not. Why? Because of the shaking. Those who stand firm in a loving way for this truth and this message and not give in to the pressures to conform to the worldly approach to religion today will cause or be part of a shaking that the insincere ones will leave in disgust, and the faithful ones out there will come in droves and they'll look at you and I and say, why didn't you tell me? Yep. So folks, I clearly see this. The papacy comes back to life. Revelation 13 talks about He comes against the church and many fall. Why? They're not reading their Bibles. They are not reading the spirit of prophecy. The world and the love is too enrooted inside of us. And the struggle becomes so real and difficult that we give in. Yes?
It's interesting. The Pope is coming to Jerusalem in a couple of weeks here in May sometime. It'll be interesting to see what develops.
Yeah, that is interesting. The Pope, I heard that. Maybe you said it a week or so ago. I didn't even know it. Got to get back on the news again. The Pope is coming to Jerusalem. That'll be very interesting. Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. We'll see what happens. I'll tell you, what I want to do is evangelize Las Vegas.
Amen.
And I want to get my life right with God. And I want to be faithful to stand in this pulpit and preach to you truths in a loving way that will encourage us to really get to know Jesus so His power can help us overcome the world that's all inside of us. And the appeal of following the worldly way. You know, it's not fun to be peculiar. That's why we have to stick together, by the way. Yes?
When did the Jesuit order become established?
Oh, man, I used to have all that stuff. Was it the Counter? It was before the Counter-Reformation or because of the Counter-Reformation? Because... Well, see, and that would be, huh? No, yes. Okay, I can say yes, because they were preeminent in coming up with the theology to protect the Pope and insulate him from being the beast. Did you know that's what the Counter-Reformation is? Two Jesuit priests came up with two contradictory theories, which are two of the main believed theories in Christianity today. Preterism and Futurism came from the Roman Catholic Church. In fact, from one of those Jesuit priests came ultimately the rapture. They didn't talk about the rapture, but it came out of that. Everything's in the future. No, that if they are, I didn't know that. All I know is they came to the forefront during the Counter-Reformation. I have to check that.
What was the era of the
Counter-Reformation? It was, 17... Just that right after Luther, when they couldn't deal with the... You know what? You need to hear this. You need to hear this. First of all, Adventists didn't invent the historicist method of interpreting Bible prophecy. We are just following what all the reformers discovered in their Bible study. Yeah. Secondly, the Roman Catholic Church was so harassed by the teaching of historicism that they called a council called the Counter-Reformation, in which they got together to figure out how to get the heat off the Pope, and they came up with these two alternative theories that contradict each other, in which the vast majority of Christians today believe either one. Preterism or Futurism. It's incredible to read this history. Yes? Ribera and Alcazar. Reformation. Yeah. Yes? A Jesuit is an order that vows itself to the Pope to do a certain thing. Yes. It's a military arm. In this case, they were the militant arm. Where
anything that they considered a heresy or a heretic,
they would destroy it. So, you know, Dean, I'm going to research what you said. It's very likely they were in existence before the Reformation. Anyway, let me show you this. In the last days, it says the King of the North will come against the beautiful land. In the last days, that's the church, and many will fall. Verse 42 says, Egypt. Notice what 42 says. And then he will stretch out his hand against other countries, and the land of Egypt will not escape. Now, spiritually, what is Egypt now? Spiritually. Remember what the Pharaoh said to Moses. Who is God that I should worship him? Here's atheism and agnosticism. The papacy will even overcome their philosophies. We see the wall coming down. The wall came down. The Iron Curtain came down. All that's left is China and India. And we know that either the hand or the head. And I'll never forget when George Bush Sr. was able to pull together a coalition of Arab nations to fight against one of its brothers. Showed me that when it's expedient, they will join together. And what's the Bible example? Tell me who hated the Pharisees the most. The Sadducees. Tell me who hated the Sadducees the most. The Pharisees. And what did the two do at the very end to Jesus? They joined together because they had a common enemy. You see? It's repeating again. Do not allow this idea of the Muslims and their hordes and being so fanatical that they would kill men, women, and children deviate you from the issue of the law of God. Even though I'm concerned about that, that isn't the issue for us in the last days. The issue for us is teaching the people the three angels' messages that Jesus is coming very soon, and hardly anybody is aware of that. just like the first time he came. And folks, who did he come to the first time? Did he come to the world? Who did he come to? His own. And who are the only ones that welcomed him? The shepherds. The only ones. Until the wise men showed up. And Herod said, where's the Messiah going to be born? And when? And they rushed off and they came right back and said, in Bethlehem now. Now, if you were one of the... Did I say wise men? I meant the priests. If you were one of the priests and the Messiah was born, what would you have done? You would have? That's what they should have done, I know. Yeah.
John would have.
They didn't. They didn't go there. The only ones that went there were the army that Herod sent to kill the babies, two years and younger. They're the only ones. I mean, there's something wrong here. We've got to understand it's happening again right now. And though I have respect for the terrorists in the sense that, yes, they have sway and some sort of political clout because they're so insanely bloodthirsty, the point is, that isn't the issue. It isn't oil in the Middle East, okay? It's the law of God. It's Christ's high priestly ministry versus an earthly ministry. It's worshiping the true God of heaven the way He asks us to worship, not the way that makes people feel good and brings them into a church where they can look any way, act any way, think any way, and feel warm fuzzies. Whew. I should have gone straight to verse 40.
You know, well, that's why, you know, that's why they originally attacked us, because the USA was known as a Christian nation. And, you know, they are not too hip with Christians. And then also, when they showed the people on the films and stuff, you know, they put the gun to their head and said, you convert or die, you know. And
well, that's going to be played out again, but we're not going to die. No, we can't keep it to ourselves. In fact, let me show you something very... If I can read verse 43, but he will gain control over the hid treasures of gold and silver and all over the precious things of Egypt, Liberia, Ethiopia will follow in his heels. Everybody knows that back then, prior to the time of the end, Egypt was very wealthy. There was gold and everything. The king of the north will have unlimited resources. Okay? He will have unlimited resources. We're interpreting this spiritually now. Now here's the good news, the exciting news. So we get verse 40, in the time of the end he comes back alive. Verse 41, he even sweeps into the church and the church falls for a lot of its baloney. Verse 42, he even takes on Egypt, and Egypt, of course, is the headquarters of atheism and agnosticism, and they side with him. And then he has unlimited resources, and here it is. I love this, and I'm not afraid to say it because I believe it with all my heart. But rumors from the east and the north will disturb him, and he will go forth with great wrath to destroy and annihilate many. What in the world could make the king of the north so angry that he's determined to go out and destroy and annihilate many? The three angels' messages. I clearly see. Let me tell you how I know this. Notice the direction they come from. What is east? First east, what is east? The Lord comes from the east. Of course, because of our rotation, everything comes from the east. But it comes from the east. The sanctuary faces what? The Garden of Eden was facing what way? You go through it spiritually, and the east is the significant direction. These are tidings that come from heaven and from the north. Okay? What is the north? Okay, let's sing. Great is the Lord and greatly to be praised in the city of our God, in the mountain of His holiness, beautiful for situation, the joy of the whole earth. Is Mount Zion on the sides of the north, the city of the great king? The sides of the north is God's judgment. That's where His throne sits. Tidings from heaven of judgment come and infuriate the king of the north because he can't deal with the spirituality. He only knows how to deal with threats. He knows how to put a gun to your head and force you to capitulate to his beliefs until someone looks at him and says, go ahead and pull the trigger. I worship the Creator God of heaven who made the Sabbath for all His people. And the three angels' messages of the book of Revelation describe Him. A group of people filled with the Holy Spirit will in loving way preach this incredible message of the three angels, which is unpopular, which is not wanted, which goes against the grain of everything we know. He can't deal with it because it's the power of God that he's fighting against. And he comes out like a roaring lion and he does what? He passes a Sunday law. Okay, now I'm glad you said that because this gives me an opportunity to restate what I stated already. Please stay away from these speculations, folks. Please. Don't try to give Obama this and because of this and because. Let God play that out. We've got to preach the three angels' messages, not chase down these even exciting theories. That does get our interest. It is a side issue. Will you please understand that? I really feel that way. And I'm hearing preachers. You know, Michael just told us he heard a preacher preach that. And then the people get all excited. And then they start studying this out. That isn't where it's at right now. I'm serious. By the way, would I like to go off on some of these? Yeah, they attract me too. That isn't the issue. The issue is we need to be preaching the three angels' messages, and it will infuriate the king of the north and cause him, in verse 44, or verse 45, I already said it, and he will pitch his tents in his royal pavilion between the seas and the beautiful holy mountain. Now, what does that mean? He will be so infuriated that he will pitch his army's tents, his command tents, between the Mediterranean Sea and the Dead Sea, right at the door of Jerusalem, which is the church. A clear picture here that the king of the north will turn all his anger on the church because it's keeping the commandments of God in spite of his insistence of us obeying his teaching. Yep, you see that? And that's when we start to flee. By the way, actually the fleeing, I think, takes place before he shows up. I want you to look here. Under verse 45, what is pictured here? This is the literal implementation of the Sunday law that was passed sometime previously. In verse 45. I want you to look later on at Isaiah 8, 6 through 8, in which it talks about Syria coming against Israel right up to their neck, it says. Military conquest. In this case, it is literal physical persecution for the beliefs of the church. And by the way, notice the last part of that verse. Yet he will come to his end and no one will help him. The king of the north will come to his end. Now I want to make a statement here. If you read carefully your Desire of Ages, you'll see this. That probation closes when they pass, I believe, probation closes when they pass the Sunday law. Remember, the Sunday law will anticipate, when a law is passed, it's usually dated for a certain time. Okay? So the minute the law is passed, that's when it's over. We're sealed. Verse 44, the Holy Spirit has been poured out. The three angels' messages have been preached with power. He goes berserkal, institutes the civil authorities to pass a law, and he begins to implement it in verse 45. Now, I want to show you what happens in the very next verse. When that happens, it says, now at that time, Michael, the great prince who stands over the sons of your people, will stand up. You know what? I'm done. That's it. And when he stands up, that means he leaves the sanctuary and begins to come back to earth. And if you read it carefully, it takes time. Not a lot of time, but it takes time. And right then also, the plagues begin to be poured out. And that's the time of trouble such as never was. And that's when we'll be spending time in prayer, aggressively seeking God to make sure our sins are forgiven. In the meantime, when Michael stands up, there's not going to be any deaths. I can read that to you. In fact, at prayer meeting, I read that to you. That at that time, he will not allow anyone to die because there's no reason for you to die because probation is closed. There's no one that's going to be converted by you dying a martyr's death. He stands up and he begins to come back. And we're told that we're surrounded by angels and they protect us. In fact, the great controversy that I read a snippet of during prayer meeting on Wednesday night says, in anticipation, some will try to kill those who are fleeing away, and angels dressed as soldiers will make their swords break and fall helplessly as we escape. It says that clearly. Now, prior to that, I know there'll be some, probably deaths, pastors or conference presidents or whatever who stand up will be put in prison to make examples of. She says that when Jesus comes, there'll be those in prison. But we're not talking about the dark ages when millions of Christians were martyred. There's no reason for it. Remember, the love of many wax cold. They are becoming more hard-hearted. The Holy Spirit is being withdrawn. God is not going to allow that to happen. There's no reason for it. Conversions aren't going to take place. But we're not there yet. Before it happens. Man, I'm really going over here. Michael stands up, folks. Then there's a time of trouble such as never was. Since there was a nation until that time. And that at that time, your people, everyone who is found written in the book, will be delivered. See, at that time, that's what happens when they go to implement. When they pass that Sunday law, that's it. That's it right there. And even before it's implemented, probation closes, Jesus leaves the sanctuary, we're already heading out, no one's going to die at that point. By the way, it seems to me that non-Adventists people are beginning to agitate the Sabbath more than we are. More and more of them are saying, you know, the Saturday Sabbath really is there. It's a day of rest. I go to church on Sunday, but it's a day of rest. They're recognizing it now, but it's a form of the Sabbath that is accommodates their thinking, not what the Bible says. The counterfeit, right? It's just like when the Catholic Church, again, brilliance of the Catholic Church, they sort of saw this thing, and so what did they do? They instituted going to church on Saturday night. And they say, I go to church on Sabbath now because that's Saturday instead of Sunday. And now some of the other evangelical churches are members, and people are saying, you know, the Sabbath is a day of rest. And they're starting to say, well, I go to church on Saturday, or I stay at home and I rest, but I go to church on Sunday. That's what they say. So you see, it's starting to come to the forefront. The point is, we've got to be there to help unmuddy the waters and see what we can do.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage you. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.